Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money. And hold that money. And practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with your politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And so you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. And even though you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march or demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
Now learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And in the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him, and then you felt like you wasn't worthy, and so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room, and I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me, and I said, I want you to do this graph for me, and that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way because your package is going to keep going right on by because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box going to get sent back to sender. And now you're going to have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Okay, I had to. I'm getting reacclimated to my board here. All right, today on It's My House, we have a live in studio guest. The topic is Dr. Dorothy Lavinia Brown, and we're going to have somebody in who knows her, who knew her very well, to discuss it. I mean, you know, to share who Dr. Dorothy Lavinia Brown. I mean, she's got her own Wikipedia page for starters. Anyway, 619-768-2945 is the number to call in if you got any questions. But let's just sit back and listen to. I think this is a good way to you know, we're at the end of the year, so this is a good way to end the year. Well, it's not quite the end, but almost. And get some motivation going into the new year. So we have in studio today, and she'll be speaking about Dorothy. I'm saying Dr. Dorothy Lavinia Brown. And we have Lola Denise Brown, who will be sharing with us who Dr. Brown was. And then she's got a story too that I'd like you guys to hear as well. So good morning, Ms. Brown.
Good morning. Good morning. How are you today?
Better than terrific, particularly since you're here. Well, tell us who Dr. Dorothy Lavinia Brown is. Like, she's got her own Wikipedia page, so she did something.
Well, before she became my mother, Dr. Dorothy Brown was a child who was very ostracized in her day. She was not allowed to be born in a hospital because of the color of her skin. She was told on a constant basis that you'll never be nothing because you're black. And back in her day, black people were not encouraged to become anything other than domestic help. She was a remarkable woman.
Let's get a little bit more backstory on this. Where was she born and where did she grow up?
She was born in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
But okay.
At 5 months old, her mother had gone to Troy and put her in an orphanage. Don't try to get me to say the name of that orphanage because it's one of those names I cannot pronounce. But at 5 months old, she was put in an orphanage. She grew up in the orphanage in Troy, New York, in upstate Troy, New York. And she was there until she was about 12 or 13 years old. She was sent back to her mother several times because the people there, they cared about my mom so much, even though they were white, they cared about my mom so much that they did not want her to go in what they called in service. So what happened was they would send her back to her mother. They did that five times, but each time she ran away and came back to the orphanage. She got her tonsils out while she was there in the orphanage, and it struck a nerve in her. It struck a good nerve in her because even though she was afraid of the lights and everything because she thought she was tough, she was going to go in there wide awake and she was going to get her tonsils out. When she got and saw up under the lights and saw the lights, it scared her to death, and they said, don't bring this kid back in here until she's asleep. But she made up in her mind right then and there that day she made the decision she was going to be a cutting doctor. Not a surgeon, but a cutting doctor.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm. And so she became what she wanted to be. She persevered. She had a different type of mindset. She made sure that everything that she did, no matter what anyone told her, you're black. Oh, you're black. You'll never be anything. Oh, you're black. You're only going to do this. Oh, you're black. You know, she didn't listen to that. She was the type of person that she went to college. She did domestic work while she was going to college. And then she met up with some people with the United Methodist Church who paid her way through medical school, which was Meharry Medical College here in Nashville, Tennessee. She became professor of surgery. She has a building named after her up there. She became chief of surgery at Riverside Hospital. She was assistant chief of surgery at Meharry Medical, at George W. Hubbard Hospital, which was part of Meharry Medical College. And she just did a plethora of things that that allowed her to get all kinds of recognition and awards and go to speak to children and speak in different places. She was even a doctor in Mount Bayou, Mississippi, where she used to take me with her all the time. And, I mean, she was just an amazing, amazing woman.
Sounds like it. Well, now, obviously she was a above average student, particularly when it comes to math and science in high school. After she graduated from high school, did she have any difficulty getting into college, or I guess maybe none at all, or what?
She had a bit of difficulty getting into college because of the way she was. My mom was not just your average person. She liked getting into trouble. I have a shirt that said, "Women who behave do not make history." Well, she was a misbehaver. And the college at Bennett in Greensboro, North Carolina, she graduated from Bennett College, which used to be an all-girls college at one time. She got put out one time, and they said don't send her back. But the United Methodist Women's Conference saw something in my mother and sent her back to college because they wanted her to get her degree so that she would be able to go to Meharry Medical College and get that cutting degree. Yeah. Well, when she went to Meharry Medical College, she used to tell me a story all the time. She said, you know, she would do everything that they would tell her to do. And, of course, they gave her a hard time because she was a woman. She was basically the only one. She was the only woman going through the surgical program. They weren't going to let her go through it because they said that a woman could not stand the rigors of a surgical program. But
right.
Thanks be to God, Dr. Matthew Walker, who was my godfather, he is the one that allowed her to come into the surgical program, and that's how she became a cutting doctor.
Did she ever write a book or anything documenting, you know, her? Because she's got...
She does have a book. It was never published, but I will say that I am doing something with it. I can't really exactly say what I'm doing with it, but I am doing something with it. And when it does come out, I hope everyone, you know, will... support what I have done with it. Like I said, I really can't talk about it right now, but
sure.
I will be able to talk about it hopefully in months to come.
Okay, all right. Well, for those listening, once again, now Dr. Dorothy Lavinia Brown, she does have a Wikipedia page. So if you just type in her name in any search engine, the Wikipedia page will pop up. Now, she is your mother. So how was it? I mean, I guess she taught you. I mean, did she teach you how? I guess she did. Because to become a doctor, you've got to be pretty good at academics. And you've got to be a very disciplined person. So what were some of the things just by being around her, being her daughter, rubbed off on you?
Well, she started reading to me at the age of 6 months. And this is the story that she told me. And by the time I was one, I was reading books. She said she didn't believe I could read the book. Until one day she started reading me the book, and what she would do is she would read to me and she would point to each word as she read to me. And she said that one day I told her, oh, Mama, quit pointing at the words. Let me read it to you. And so I read her the book that she was reading to me. And she said she couldn't believe it. So what she did was she got another book, and she said, well, if you can read this one, she said, what can you do with that one? And when she handed me the other book, she noticed that I was reading that book, and I was pointing to the words like she was pointing to the words at me, and I was reading the book with her. So anyway, I'm sorry, that was someone got a doctor's appointment coming up, and so that was someone reminding me. That was the type of person she was. She was very much into education. She was very much into you learning about things. You didn't have to like it. You just had to learn about it. You know, as long as you knew about it, you could be up on it or whatever. She was good with that. So, living with her, it was an education, actually. And I was a happy kid. I was a good. Very happy kid.
Well, that's very good to hear. Now, how much time do you have? Because we don't want to have you late for any appointment.
Oh, I won't be late. I'm getting myself together right now.
Okay.
We're an hour behind you, and I have, I think, a 10:30 appointment, if I'm not mistaken.
Right now it's it's almost 11 o'clock here. We're an hour ahead of you.
Okay.
Well, now let's put the focus on you now. So tell us about yourself and some of the things that you have going on, and what are you planning on? You know, because you're in the Nashville, Tennessee area.
Okay. Like you said, my name is Lola. I'm Lola Denise Brown. I was named after my grandmother, who was my mom's foster mom, because her real parents gave her up and put her in an orphanage. I didn't explain that to you about her. She was fostered by a couple named Samuel and Lola Redmond in upstate New York. So when she got her degree and she got her practice going and everything, and she was over at Meharry College, she became professor, and she decided she wanted a child because she wanted to pay it forward for what had been done for her. So she adopted me. She adopted me at birth. My birthday is in August, and it was in 1956. And so when she adopted me, I have to say that day had to become the day that God smiled on me. And even though I may not have known it then, I know it now, because the way that she persevered, and I could see her perseverance, it stuck with me. My mom became the first Black female surgeon in the South. She also became the first Black woman to be elected to the Tennessee State Legislature, but she was also the first Black woman to be single in the state of Tennessee and adopt a child. That was me. Growing up as Dr. Dorothy L. Brown's child, with any kid, you look at them and you say, well, you need to be like your mother. You should do this like your mother does, and you should do that. But see, I was a radical as well. And she kind of understood how I was, because she was that same way. But it turned me into a person that whatever I saw that I wanted, I would go after it. And I would go after it with all of the energy that was in me, whatever dream I had, you know, I went after it. And so because of it, it kind of messed me up in a way that that caused me some problems, but still I go after everything with the same energy that I feel that she had or that I feel that I have. Right now I'm an entrepreneur. I am working with a company called GS Partners. We have Bitcoin, NFTs, which are non-fungible tokens. We also have digital real estate as well. We have a lot of incentives in our program that allows a person not to be able to have to deal with a regular bank. So basically the government doesn't know what you're doing as far as your account is concerned. Company is located in Dubai, and we have a billionaire who is backing us and helping us close the wealth gap for melanated people and those who are poor.
Okay. All right. Well, go ahead. I'm listening.
Oh, and I'm just saying that was basically what I do. I invite other people to come into the program. A lot of people try to say it's a pyramid or whatever they used to call those things. But we're not a pyramid company. Companies like this, you have to be sponsored in. You don't get in any other kind of way. You get invited into it. And also, once you get your own account, you're able to do whatever you want to in your own account. I was listening to your promo at the beginning, and this guy was talking about God, and he said, you know, look at me, you know, look at me, look at what I'm doing now. And that's the way I feel, because if it wasn't for God opening up my eyes to this program, I feel like my life would have been more or less absolutely nothing. I've grown older. I've gotten sick. I've had a lot of things happen to me. But through it all, God has had my back. I had non-small cell lung cancer. I had that in 2019. It went into remission in 2020. And just this year, I had brain cancer inside of a tumor in my brain, and did what I needed to do to get rid of the cancer, and it was completely obliterated. Twice God has had my back in everything that I have pursued as far as my illness and my health is concerned. And now he's got my back in this company. I'd like to invite anyone who would like to take a look at the company to give me a call or to look me up on Facebook and just, you know, message me, because I would be glad to let them know about the company and to give them an invitation link so that they can join and begin to do what the rich people do, and that is not spend money on things that don't make you money. But what the rich people do is they sacrifice and they save in assets so that they can leave generational wealth for their family, their children.
Okay. All right. Well, we're going to – you know what? I forgot to – I was supposed to send you something on the community meals thing. You know what? I'll get to it. It just totally slipped my mind. But I'll send that to you.
Because I was looking for that and I didn't see it.
Right, right.
So,
I just remembered it just now. I had a whole lot of things going on. It totally slipped my mind. I had to apologize about that. That sounds Very interesting. Now, you're in Nashville, and we know
Correct.
Nashville as, what, Country Music USA?
Supposed to be Country Music USA, but
okay.
we have other music down here other than country music.
Okay. Well, now I heard Memphis also is known for good barbecue. True or false?
Memphis, Tennessee, they have some great restaurants there. They do have great barbecue there. But I'm partial to Nashville, Tennessee. Because when you have family here that you can go to and you can be around, et cetera, during the holidays, especially the warm months, that's where the best barbecue is going to come, is from a family cookout or a family get-together. I'm pretty sure they have those in Memphis, but Nashville, Tennessee is the bomb.
Interesting. Well, now, Nashville is the largest city in Tennessee, right?
Most definitely. That's why we're the capital.
Okay. All right. Well, there's a lot of... now, what, Vanderbilt? Is Vanderbilt in Nashville?
Yes, Vanderbilt is in Nashville, Tennessee.
Okay. 'Cause I remember in college, when I would be going back home from spring break, and it was always on this particular route, because I went to school in Texas. So this particular airline, with one of the stop-offs would be Nashville. And there was always a bunch of other college students down there. Yeah, they were returning back. They were going back to Vanderbilt. So I said, yeah, right. Pretty popular school, but that's just one school. Like say, Meharry is a well-known medical school.
It's a well-known HBCU medical school. It is a historically black college or university. It is one of the well-known historical black colleges who will accept anyone who wants to become anything in the medical field.
Now, hold it now. That term, anyone's a big word, because medical school is definitely, I mean, you got to be, I've never been enrolled in nothing like that, but I'm imagining you've got to be pretty proficient at math and science coming out of high school.
Most definitely, and I didn't mean anyone in that sense. I meant anyone who is inclined in that way, because if you don't have the stuff down within you, if God hasn't given you that, please don't try to do it, because we need people to save us, not continue to do some of the
and
things
I imagine,
that have gotten rid of us.
I imagine that, and this might be at the typical HBCU. HBCUs, and I went to Howard grad, not undergrad, but I went to Howard grad school. I didn't complete it for a year. And what I can say about, I think this is reflective of or representative of a lot of, matter of fact, all HBCUs probably, is those professors, they're not going to cut you any slack. You got to bring it.
No, they're not going to cut you any slack.
Yeah, they're not going to cut you. They might let you, they might have maybe a more liberal policy. So they'll give you the opportunity, but once you're to get in, but once you're in, you can't loaf your way through.
No, you've got to do the work. I went to what used to be American Baptist Seminary, which is now American Baptist College. And to get in was easy. That's not the problem. Where everything lies is, once you get in, what kind of work are you going to do? it's not so much that it's rigorous, but it is very it's very tedious. It's a tedious type of study for whatever it is you want to study. You have to have enough energy to be able to finish. And
right.
I was on my way to finish at American Baptist until I got sick. And I'm waiting for all of this to subside now so I can go on and I can finish because I believe that a college education, it does help you. It helps you in whatever it is you want to do. You can't always follow the crowd. You have to follow what God gives you. And so
right.
I believe a lot of times this is why we don't make it. A lot of times this is why we don't go to college, because college is not inbred in a lot of things that we want to do. So, but I mean, I can't say that it doesn't help, because it does.
Right. Well, I think the most valuable thing about college is the body of people that are there. Because you're able to meet people, and I don't care what kind of college, including community colleges. I think the biggest or the most valuable asset of any college setting, including community colleges, which used to be called junior colleges, are the people that are there, because you're allowed to build a social and professional network on campus.
Very important.
And now things are offered online. But with virtual schools, typically you can see everybody's, like a Zoom call.
Right.
You can network with those people. And then you can network with people, because I imagine at Meharry, like any other college, you probably had students from foreign countries there as well.
Yes, they do.
Yeah, and I like that aspect of it. So you can meet people from, God, you name it, people that you're not going to meet in everyday life.
Yeah, you can meet people from anywhere in the world at Meharry Medical College, just like you
right,
can meet people from anywhere in the world at Vanderbilt. But
right. There's
a difference, as far as I'm concerned, there's a difference between Meharry and Vanderbilt, and that is the type of person that they put out there. Meharry was known very much so for putting out caring doctors. And I believe all of the other hospitals believe that that's what they do, but they don't do it the Meharry way.
Okay.
Meharry has always put out doctors who have a heart for the people. You know, a lot of times I would watch patients come through my mom's office that could not pay, and they brought food. You know, kind of like a bartering system, you know. And so, anyway, these are the kind of doctors that Meharry Medical College puts out, as opposed to some of these big conglomerate colleges that you have all over the United States.
Right. Well, Meharry's been around for a long time, so obviously it's been financially sustainable. And it, you know what? There's not that many HBCU medical schools in the United States. It's you got Meharry,
no.
You have
yes.
Howard University,
uh-huh.
And you might have one more.
Morehouse.
You got something down here in Florida. I forgot the name of it.
Uh-huh.
But it
there's they have,
not.
There are several, and Meharry hosts. An HBCU medical college weekend or week, they definitely host that, and they're like 10. I say they're about 10.
They're
medical colleges.
I thought it was down to 3.
Well, no, because I've seen several medical colleges that have graced Meharry Medical College's doorstep when they do have that day. Yes.
Okay. Well, now let's see. Now, all right. I'm reading here online. There are 4 of them. They say the nation's 4 historically black medical schools have labored throughout their existence to address the racial. Let's see. I'm trying to get the names of them.
I know Morehouse. If I'm not mistaken, I know Morehouse has one. I saw several of them there, and it was more than 4.
Let's see, what percentage of black doctors went to HBCUs? 9 of the top 10 colleges that graduate the most African-American students who go on to earn, no, I don't want PhDs, I want MDs.
MDs are good.
Let's see, 12 medical schools with the most black medical students.
Yeah. Right, right.
We'll have to do a. Yeah, I think there's one here somewhere in Florida.
I'm really not sure where they are, but. But I mean, they are. I know. Yes, there are at least 4, but I've seen more than 4. I'm on my way out the door. That's why you hear all the noise in the background. Yeah.
Okay,
but there are more than 4.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll have to do. Now I'm trying to find my seat. We'll have to do that probably. I haven't done a podcast on it.
Okay.
We'll have to do one on that. But medical school, I consider that a boot camp.
Most definitely.
Yeah, the first thing, they don't let anybody in for the most part. But definitely don't let anybody out.
Well, there is a test that you have to take in order to get into any medical school. And what happens is if you don't pass that test the first time, you have to wait so long in order to take the test again. And if you don't pass it the second time, then you can forget it. I know that's the way they use. I don't know if they still do it
that
way.
They probably still do it that way. A test to get in. Well, you know, they sort of do that with some schools when it comes to graduate programs.
Right.
And with law school, California's got a different rule now. California, you don't need to take the LSAT. However, put it this way, online law schools, However, to be admitted to the bar in California,
right?
After a year, you've got to take what they call in California the baby bar. If you don't pass the baby bar, then you're not supposed to. I mean, they give you, you got to wait a certain amount of time, because really, law school is really to prepare you to take the bar examination.
Right. Okay.
But it's definitely not. It's not easy.
Okay. But
I'm glad to share with us about your mother. And like I said, we're going to have we've never done a show on somebody medical before, so we're going to have to probably do a show on people that might be interested in enrolling in law, not law school, but medical school.
Okay.
I'd like to put my
number out there in case anyone
would
be interested in VS Partners.
All right.
My phone number, the phone number that they can call is 615-902-5130.
Okay, great.
And that is the number that they can call. I can text message them some information if they like. I believe very much so that you can earn while you learn. So this is one of those programs that you do that in, and I would very much like for people to give me a call and take a look at the program.
All right. And for people that missed it yesterday, we're partnering up with Ms. Brown. We're going to be doing boots on the ground community meals in Nashville,
sir.
Among other places, but definitely Nashville, where people can empowered. All right, so thank you for coming on, sharing that information about you. I'm sure we'll have you on plenty more times.
Okay.
Because it seems like there's a lot going on down there in Memphis. I had another guest on, a friend of mine. She does cable television down there. I don't know if she still does cable television. Nashville. Amani Murph. Amani Murph. Heard her name?
No, I have not heard her name.
She's done some cable television in the Nashville market. So.
Okay.
But that's such a large city. How many people live in over 600,000 people?
Oh, in Nashville?
Yeah.
Got over a million people here.
Now that's in Metro Nashville. But what about the city proper?
Metro
Nashville. Yeah, I know it's over a million. Yeah, but in the city proper of Nashville,
I would have,
because
there
are only 10 cities. Yeah, and there's only 10 cities in the United States that have a population of a million people or more. That's in the city proper. But, yeah, definitely Nashville Metro is over a million people, though, and whatnot. So, thank you. I know you got to get ready for your appointment, so people, just tune in. And thank you, Ms. Brown. I'll give your number out again.
My number is 615-902-5130. And they can call me anytime between 10 a.m. and 7 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Okay. Now, if you
–
will be on Clubhouse today. Now, once again, Clubhouse has no dialing number like we do here on Blog Talk Radio. But we'll be on Clubhouse, where we've been for the last 3 weeks. But we'll be on Clubhouse today at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. That's 5:30 Central Standard Time, just for your local time zone globally. And our club on there, or room on there, is titled Housing on Demand. Housing on Demand. So we got a live session at 6:30 today or 5:30 Central Standard Time, based on where you are or whatever. So thank you, Ms. Brown, for being on, and we'll be looking forward to having you back here real soon.
And I'm definitely going to do my best to tune in this evening.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to Business Boutique. Yes. I'm so excited about today because I get to introduce you to one of my new awesome friends. Her name is Mignon Francois. Don't I just sound fancy saying that? Y'all, Mignon is incredible. She is just a light in this world and bubbling with personality. She makes me seem quiet and very low-key. She is the founder and owner of the Cupcake Collection. She has a location here in Nashville and one in New Orleans, a multi-million dollar business that she literally started from scratch. You're going to love her story and love her even more. Check this out. Hey, everyone, and welcome to Business Boutique. I'm so excited because I get to hang out with my very good friend, Mignon Francois. Mignon, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. Okay. I'm so excited.
I have talked you up. Ever since you did an interview here at our staff meeting, you are just this light. So for anyone that doesn't know your business and what you do, let's just start with a little bit about who you are and what you do.
I am a stay-at-home mom turned baking prodigy of some sort, where I took the last $5 that I had and I gambled on ourselves. And turn that into over $10 million in the last 10 years.
Oh, is that all? Okay. We're going to unpack how she did that. Don't worry. Okay, so let's back up. Let's back up to the beginning. Mm-hmm. You went through a really low point, and even as you were telling your story, I so identified with that, not because I've been through something similar myself, but my mom has. Mm-hmm. So my mom found herself newly single at 33 with a six-month-old baby and $64 to her name. She had a little bit more money than you did, and trying to figure out, how do I turn this money into a life? How do I turn this money into something that we can survive on, besides just food this week, something beyond that? And she bought supplies and went and made cakes and then sold them the next day and turned that money into what is now her bakery 35 years later. Yeah. So I loved your story, but let's go back to like how you got to that point and what was going on in your head, because now you're this great success story, but at that time you didn't know. Mm-hmm. You didn't know what lied ahead. Mm-hmm. You've got babies. How many kids did you have at that point?
At that point I had six
kids. Okay. Mm-hmm. And you have seven now. Mm-hmm. And so, and you're broke and you're like, take us back there and what that was like and what was going through your head in that moment of feeling like you're in survival mode.
Well, we had come to Nashville for a better life.
Right.
And then as soon as we got here, the job that we got here for fell through. Mm-hmm. Last one hired is the first one fired. But I told God when I came to Nashville, God, I want a home for my children. I'm not doing this same thing anymore. I'm not living in apartments for the rest of our lives. I want a yard for them to play and a fence and rooms that they can call their own. And so almost a year to the date, we moved out of that apartment into what would become our forever home. But it wasn't easy and it wasn't cute or simple, right?
Right.
When we got it, my husband, I was married at the time. My husband called me and he said, I found this house, this cute little neighborhood. It reminds me of New Orleans. And he brought me down there to look at the house. And I was like, this is an ugly house. And the place where you're taking me to eat today better be better than
this house.
And so we went and I saw the people coming out of the houses surrounding this little restaurant. And I said, take me back to that house. And we went inside and we were standing with the floorboards around our knees because we had fallen through the floors. It was condemned.
Yeah.
And it was like, it's beautiful.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. I love it.
And there was a sign outside that said owner financing. And I thought that meant that the owner would just give you the money. Like, I really thought they were giving the house away, but that it was just so bad that nobody really wanted it. And so we called and we were like, you know, we'll take the owner financing.
Yeah. He's like, not having any idea what you're saying. Yeah. Right, sure.
And he was like, it doesn't work like that. And he's like, people want this house. They want to turn it into restaurants and all kinds of stuff. I'm like, nobody's going to do that.
Right.
And so you should just be, you should just take my deal. I want owner financing. I don't want to pay you for a year. I don't have any money to give you down, as a matter of fact, because I need every bit of whatever money I'm going to get to renovate this condemned property. And he was like, get your life. Goodbye.
Yeah, yeah.
But some time went by, and they actually ended up calling us back and said, hey, you know, are you still interested in the house? You mean the one that everybody's going to buy? Like,
right,
all
right.
These people, yeah,
people lined up. Yeah, sure.
Want to put restaurants in? Yeah, we're still interested. And so he called us down to talk about working on some other houses for him in exchange for the sweat equity on this house. Now, he's not going to give us any money,
yep.
But I'm going to give you sweat equity towards the $10,000 you need to buy this house, and then then I'll owner finance it for you. But we didn't have a job,
right?
Because last one hired is the first one fired, yeah. And so it's like, yes, we'll take it.
Yeah,
we didn't know how we were going to eat though.
Right.
We just believed that God wasn't surprised,
right,
about this, and that if this was our house, he was going to make a way. And so we showed up with our kids to start renovating that first property that they gave us to work on. And by the end of the 4 weeks that it took us to do it, he had paid us $8,000 in cash,
wow,
for our family,
wow,
to take care of us, when he made it clear he wasn't giving us anything.
Sure.
So it's like, when you follow in obedience what God tells you to do, he's responsible for the outcome.
Mm.
And that's the thing that I've learned over the whole process of doing the Cupcake Collection. And any story that I hear, all these women begin to come and tell me about how they want to start. And that has been my life's work now, Christy, to do what it is. I believe that I want to show other women what they can do if they believe.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm using my mouth for. That's,
yeah,
using my energy, my time, my gift, my talents for. And so it took us 4 weeks to flip that house for them. And we got the property. We moved into it. It was 2 rooms and a half bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
And that half bathroom was a toilet and a tub.
Mm-hmm.
My children didn't complain about the fact that we had plywood floors. I mean, they were happy that we were together. And I don't think that they knew that we were broke.
Yeah.
And that's a word that I won't even allow my children to really say,
mm-hmm,
you know. And it's something that we don't really use in our family,
mm-hmm,
because broken has nothing to do with the money.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And they didn't know that we were broke.
Yeah.
We didn't have any money, and our situation was dire.
Mm-hmm.
And my husband and I were going through a time where, you know, the economy was tanking, and one of the biggest things that makes marriages fail is finance.
That's right.
And so we didn't have any.
Yeah.
And then we didn't have much work either.
Right.
And so I prayed, and I said, God, give me something,
mm-hmm,
that I can do to help my husband make ends meet. Because to me, he looked like death. And when you're really close to someone, as you are when you have a spouse, you can read them.
Right.
You know, like, I could see it underneath his skin.
Yeah.
Like, he looked like death to me.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't know that he wasn't dying. He was dying to me.
Mm.
That our relationship was dying,
mm-hmm,
and that God was resurrecting something new in me. Now, I'm not an advocate for divorce,
sure,
you know, in any kind of way, but everybody has to want to work for it,
right?
And so when you find yourself in a position where after 21 years of marriage, my husband says, I want a divorce.
Mm.
And even in that, we still opened the Cupcake Collection together,
mm-hmm,
because it was like, what do I have?
Right.
I have nothing.
Yeah.
I have taken care of your children.
Right.
My life has been you.
Right.
And our home. Now what am I supposed to do? I had a degree, you know.
Right.
And I had used my life to raise our family.
Yeah.
What about me?
Right. Right.
And so he said, I'll stay with you to open this business.
Mm.
And that's something most people don't know. We knew when we opened that business together that he was staying long enough to get me on,
wow,
my feet.
Wow.
And so even through that, we sort of mended ourselves back together for a time, but it just,
sure,
you know, it just didn't end up working out. But what we did was, I heard God say, make cupcakes. When I asked God, I was trying to help him.
Right.
I didn't know that God was going to turn around and use it to help me.
Right.
And so I was listening to Dave Ramsey.
Uh-huh.
every day. I grew up in a household where we listened to NPR, you know,
yeah.
On the way to school every morning with our mom, we would hear the rest of the story.
We
would listen for the rest of the story. And I was kind of looking for something like that when I discovered Dave Ramsey.
Sure.
And I heard the first time I stopped on the radio station, I heard them screaming, "We're debt free."
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I got so much joy on the inside of me. I wanted that.
Yeah, sure.
And I was like, turning up the radio, what are they saying?
Yeah, yeah.
And what are they talking about? And they were going off the air. And I was like, what was that?
Yeah.
And I was panting for some of that because my mother had raised us to be debt-free. I mean, she taught me financial responsibility. She taught me that the borrower was slave to the lender. And I remember having my first credit card when I was 15 and getting punished because I couldn't pay the bill out completely when the bill came in. So not only did she take my credit card, she took everything I purchased with it, and she took my paychecks until they were paid.
Wow.
So I understood what it meant to lose my stuff, and I never wanted to lose my stuff again.
Yeah.
But here we were. I was listening to him, and I was waking up every morning at 3:17. And what I want people to know is sometimes when you get up in the morning – and you think it is that you're turning off the stove or you want to check the doors. For me, I wanted to make sure my children were breathing.
Yeah,
I think a lot of moms feel that way.
Yeah.
And turned on the TV one morning because I couldn't go back to sleep. And Wayne Dyer was on the TV, and he was saying, "The morning breeze has something to tell you.
Mm.
Do not go back to sleep." And I was like, that sounds crazy.
Right.
You're getting off my TV.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it's 3:00 in the morning. I'm looking for my remote. He says it again. And now I'm looking high and low.
Yeah.
And he says, "God is trying to talk to you. Mm. And this is the only time you'll be silent." And I was like,
well, that's true. My kids are asleep. This is the only time that it's going to be silent in my house. That's
and
valid.
I was like, I can relate to that because I know God.
That's
right. And so I sit down and listen. He says, "The thing you're getting up every morning for, that's not what it is."
Mm.
And I was like, whoa,
he's speaking to me. That's right. I love it.
And so he said, you know, "Now that you know that you're getting up for a purpose to hear God, it's going to be hard." Took me about a week after following his instructions to put my feet on the floor and show up in my living room one morning at 3:17 with the Lord. "God, I'm here. What are we doing?"
Yeah.
"I don't really know how to hear you. I really don't know what you sound like. And if you come in here right now, God, please don't, because I'm
scared out of my mind." That's right.
Right. "I don't want you to show up, but I really kind of want you to show
up."
Right.
Right. That's right.
And so I did what the only thing I knew how to do. I saw my Bible sitting under the coffee table, and I grabbed it and I opened it to wherever it would fall. And it fell on chapter 3 of this particular book. And I ran down the 17 and I got my first word from the Lord.
Wow.
And I began to search feverishly then through the Bible in every chapter 3 that there was and every verse 17. And I would read on until it didn't apply anymore.
That's right.
Until I read the whole entire Bible that
way. Wow.
And I think it was about 6 weeks that I was, once I knew what I was getting up for, that, you know, I had seen God say, "Write the vision, make it plain." So I got me a journal. I started writing everything that I was reading. And he began to lay out for me all of the things he wanted me to know, that he loved me, that I was good enough, because I was broken, Christy. Like, I didn't think I was pretty. I didn't think I was good enough. I didn't think that I would ever be able to finish anything because I had really great ideas, but I never would finish them.
Yeah.
I would always start, but I would never finish. I've learned in the process, and God will give you so many things as you go. Follow him, and you think what you're getting up every morning to actually effectively make happen is the goal, but God has something else because his ways are not our ways.
That's right.
I know how to start. My ministry is not necessarily in finishing,
right.
But I learned that there was a positive spin on that I could help people get started. In that time, God gave me a plan. And then when he gave me that plan, one of the last verses that he said to me was, "I listen, choose life, Mignon. I lay before you life and death, blessings and curses. Choose life." So I realized that I had a responsibility in this. this was the last thing God was going to give me.
Yeah.
This was the last idea that he was going to watch me start and not follow through.
Yeah.
And, you know, because even though I'm not a finisher, there's still a way not to leave it on the side
right,
of the road.
Right,
right. Just,
right.
Oh, I'm not
there's
doing that anymore.
There's a stewardship element
yeah.
to this.
Like
right.
you can package it and give it to somebody else, or you can say this, you can write about it and teach it to someone. I mean,
right.
you're not supposed to just leave things on the side of the road.
Right.
And that's kind of like how I was doing it. And I learned at 3:17 in the morning that God had chosen me for something, and he was not playing with me, that this was going to be my life, and I could go to the left or I could go to the right. And I decided to choose life.
Mm.
And so in choosing life, I heard Dave Ramsey say, you could have a bake sale. And I thought, you could have a bake sale every single day.
Yeah.
Now, I didn't know how to bake.
Right.
Not even
minor detail. Whatever. Sure, sure. We're going to unpack that. Don't worry.
And he said, but you have these two little girls, and they can. But as we got started, my oldest daughter let me know, hey, Mom, I have a plan, and it really doesn't
it doesn't bother you and these cakes. Hey, I can relate to her. As my mom tried to pull me into the fold, I was like, my dreams don't involve icing. Thank you. I grew up with icing. Yeah.
And she wanted to go back to New Orleans. And so without her, my baby daughter wasn't interested. So now I got to learn how to bake.
Yeah.
We had all these culinary books in the house. My husband was passionate about baking and cooking and food because we're from New Orleans. And so he wouldn't help me. He's like, they got books in there. You know, I was like, fine. I had the secret weapon. My grandmother.
Mm.
My grandmother would be who the movie The Help would have been made about,
okay.
right?
Okay.
She left her children at home while she went to take care of another family.
Okay.
But every day there was food, and every day there was cake. And what I loved about going to my grandmother's house was eating. And I love when grandma would come because there would be food because my
sure.
mother didn't cook.
Sure, sure.
I mean, she's a great cook, but she's not
right,
happy
right,
about it,
right.
right? And so I would snap beans with my grandmother. And God says, honor thy father and thy mother that your days may be long on the land. And here's what I realized. Long doesn't always mean time. Long could mean abundant,
mm.
right? So that it be well
right.
with you. And so I think that God honored all the time that spent my grandma because I love that chick. You know?
Yeah, yeah,
like,
oh yeah.
I hang with
you
her.
You didn't even know at that time what that was gonna
yeah.
how that was gonna play out in your life.
I call her on the phone before unlimited long distance.
Right, sure.
And my mom's like, "Look, 5 minutes. That's
uh-huh,
it. That's
uh-huh.
all I can afford to give you." And we made a deal: if you will make the food, I will wash the dishes because I hated washing dishes. My mother hates cook. This
yep.
was when I was 17,
okay.
living at home in New Orleans, and. I said, fine, call my grandmother, told her what we're going to do. She's like, all right, this is what you need to get. Well, here I am. I've learned how to cook long distance with my grandmother
sure.
on the phone. So 17 years later, I need to do something in the kitchen. Who
right.
am I going to call?
That's right.
I'm going to call my grandmother.
That's right.
And I said, Grandma, I need to make a cake. She's like, open up your hand. Pick this much flour up, pinch your fingers together, measure to this first line. I mean, that's the way she told me how to do it. But standing there looking at everything my grandmother gave me on a piece of paper, I got my first successful thing that ever baked.
Yeah.
I learned God wanted to create this with me.
Mm.
While I couldn't bake well out of a box even. I mean, you just add the things
right,
that
right.
they say.
Two eggs is all you need, some oil.
It's going to come out. It doesn't come out for me.
Yeah.
And he was teaching me that I was going to have to depend on him.
Take me back to this season of the Lord is speaking to you at 3:17 in the morning. When did you get the idea? Was it the Dave Ramsey bake sale? You could have a bake sale. Was that when cupcakes entered your mind?
I don't know.
When did it turn into the cupcake idea?
I think it became cupcakes because I was trying to bake cakes, you know,
okay.
and I couldn't decorate them.
Okay.
And I didn't have the skill to do that.
So let's talk about that season right there. Like,
mm-hmm.
you have an idea. You're trying to do something. It's not turning out great.
Yeah.
And you need something to work for you. You need
mm-hmm.
a business. You need a plan. You're trying to provide for your family. Why did you not think, oh, this isn't for me, I should do something else? What made you press through and say, I'm going to figure this thing out, I'm
mm-hmm.
going to follow through, that type of thing? Like, talk me through that, because I think a lot of women watching and listening
mm-hmm.
are facing challenges, and they're having trouble discerning, do I push through this challenge and find a way to make it work?
Mm-hmm.
Or is this just a sign I'm not cut out for this?
Yeah.
I should actually do something different. So take me back to that, because that's difficult, I think, sometimes to know the difference.
I think for me, I really understood when I read that Bible verse, choose life, that I really thought I was going to die.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I thought it was over for us. And I was tired of being sick and tired.
Right.
You know, it's one thing to be sick, but then to be sick and to be tired,
right.
That's just drained. And I was drained of not having enough. I heard some rap lyrics.
Oh, let's have it. Okay. Bring it. Okay, I'm ready for this. We got Jesus and rap music. You are my kind of girl. Here we go.
I heard this song that has been touted as one of the best rap collaborations of all time. Jay-Z and Kanye West.
Okay.
The song is called Otis. And I'm listening to this rap song, and Kanye says, they ain't see me. Because last week, I was in my other bins. This time, I was in my other bins. And I'm like, hold on a second. He has options, and they're luxurious. And I don't have a car.
Right.
Right. You know, and it's just like, why is it that Jay-Z and Beyonce and Kanye and Lil Wayne have all this abundance? Are they more loved by you guys? Like, do they have more of your favor? And I don't.
Mm-hmm.
And I started realizing that there was something that was required of me, and that was work.
Okay.
Because Adam and Eve, when they went into the garden, and I discovered Rabbi
Lappin
on your show.
Yep.
And I started following and reading his book, and I learned this concept that they probably had the best digs of all time. I mean, you can't get a better house than the one that Adam and Eve had.
Right.
But yet work was required of them. God said, go work.
It is good. That's right. The work is good.
And
right.
I think that that's what I realized, that you think that when an idea comes to you, it should just happen.
Right.
But overnight success takes 10 years.
Yeah.
And there's a reason that it takes 10 years, because you got to learn all of the pieces, and you got to get humble. You got to be grateful for where it is that you've been in order to get more.
Yeah.
And it takes time for that revolution to happen.
Yeah.
And I learned that work was required of me, and I had to do the work.
Okay, so I think this is huge. I want to camp here for a second, because I think it's incredible that you can look at someone that is a famous, a celebrity, rich, name all the things.
Mm-hmm.
But let's even take a different example. Let's say it's not Beyonce and Jay-Z.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say it's someone in your neighborhood and they're wealthy and they have a lot of money. I think a lot of people would look at that, whether it's Jay-Z or someone in your neighborhood that drives a Benz or whatever, and they would think, well, they just got a lucky break.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they have all this help.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they have it's family money.
Uh-huh.
And what's amazing to me is you saw that as personal responsibility to respond to the opportunity, to do the work that would be required to reap the fruit that you wanted in your life, where so many people are stuck, and they've been stuck, Mignon, for 5, 10, 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
Like, well, I don't know why I'm stuck. Well, everybody else just has it easy.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody else fill in the blank. And they take a victim mentality. And if you have a victim mentality, you will get victim results.
Exactly.
And I love that you saw this.
Mm-hmm.
And someone as elevated as Beyonce and Jay-Z, which are so removed from you and I in real life, and you didn't see that as, well, of course, they're famous, they're rich, all the things that would be true.
Yeah.
They got 16 nannies, whatever. Like, if I had that would be so easy to say, but instead you thought, no, I'm going to do something different. I'm going to do some work required. You know, this is funny. This is a random sidebar here, but recently I put a thing on Instagram, actually about Beyonce and how much she practiced and worked. Like, she rehearsed.
8 hours.
Hours. Months.
Eight months. For 2 hours.
8 months for 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a lot of people like, oh, that's so encouraging. And there were a couple of people like, well, yes, she has lots of help and she's not a great example. And I'm like, there's anybody that you can find fault with or you can learn from.
Yeah.
And there are people that you can pull their work ethic. You can, you know, if someone's rocking it at their marriage, I want to go learn from them. And I mean, they're perfect and everything.
Yeah.
I may not go to Beyonce to teach me about Jesus. That's fine. But I can learn from her work ethic, right? Like, you can learn something from everyone. If someone's rocking it in an area of their life in business, I'm going to go learn business from those people that are rocking it. And I just love that was your takeaway.
Yeah.
I just want to commend you. Like, that is – that was your takeaway in that moment, where it would have been so easy to be like, well, that's them, not that's not me.
Yeah. Well,
you know what I mean?
Here's one of the things that I know is that Jesus taught in parables because they were relatable.
Right.
That you could remember a story. And so that's why it works to tell my story or to tell other people your story, because they can see themselves in it.
Right.
Well, here's the aha moment I had the other day.
Okay.
Rap songs are modern day parables.
Mm.
It's just who is delivering it.
Right.
What is the message?
Right.
Because God can use a donkey.
That's right.
To speak to you.
That's right. And he has.
And he has.
Right.
And he will. And so it's like, what are you listening to?
Mm.
My mother told us that we were great. I mean, she was the biggest cheerleader. So I think that I always had this greatness living on the inside of me. And when I was a little girl, I knew I was going to be famous. Like, I don't want that to sound arrogant or anything, but, like, I always knew I was going to be famous. I didn't know what it was going to be for. But this is why. Because I believe that God didn't waste my fabulous name on nobody knowing
it. That is a fact. That name needs to be in lights. It's a great name.
I was like, this is a fabulous name, and people need to know it. So I have to do my due diligence to make my name great.
Yeah.
So all of that was living on the inside of me. And yeah, I didn't just have the example of Beyonce, because remember, I told you about a condemned house that I moved
right,
in.
Right.
But it was in an affluent neighborhood.
Yeah.
You know, where everybody that was rich was buying up all these properties that people in my community couldn't afford to buy.
Right.
And I was like one of the few that happened to have this blessing fall upon me. God says,
You said owner financing is free. I mean, no one else knew that that's what that meant. You took advantage of that opportunity.
But God said, I will open you a window of heaven and pour you out a blessing.
Mm.
That there will not be room for you to receive it. I believe that. And here's the thing. If God is a man that he could not lie, then if we know what the promises are, all we have to do is repeat them back to him. It's just like with your kids. Mommy, you said, mommy,
they'll tell you what you said.
Oh, yeah,
Carter will not let me forget what I said.
But we don't do that to God.
Right, right.
God has told us certain things, and it's science. It will work for you if you apply it.
Yeah.
And I just got it in my heart. My neighbor across the street was a huge supporter of me. She lived in this big, gigantic mansion, just two of them, her and her husband.
Yeah.
And it's just like, I got all my kids over here.
Right.
We don't have running water half the time. We don't have electricity some of the time. And my kids never went around saying, we don't have anything.
Right, right.
There were many days that they went to school and they had to eat breakfast and lunch at school because our dinner is not sure. We're going to eat, but we were what is more commonly known in Middle Tennessee as the food insecure, meaning that you're going to eat, but you're not sure what,
right.
You're not sure what time. There were many days we ate at 10 o'clock at night because that's when something was killed to bring home to eat. But they never complained about that. And I feel like I learned at 3:17 in the morning that your reward is based on how you go through the problem.
That's good.
Your provision
is
based on the way that you travel through the problem. I didn't want the poor me award.
Yeah. Even your attitude with the plywood floors. Like you're like that. I love that you're talking about that because that matters. I think a lot of people in business or in life, they are in a season of difficulty, small beginnings, unimpressive starts, and they're like, poor me.
Yeah.
I only have 200 followers. Poor me. It's like, if you're not faithful with the 200, God's not going to give you 2 million. So it's like, if you don't have the right heart, the right spirit, the right gratitude, the right humility, the right work ethic with the 200 followers, with your humble beginnings, with your unimpressive, terrible first keynote that you ever did, or your first product, your first cake that just sucked and no one wanted to eat, if you're not faithful with that, he's not going to give you more to be ungrateful and unhappy and joyless about. So I just love your attitude and your spirit through all this, because there's such important lessons. I think so often in business we think, oh, I just need the business steps.
Yeah.
It's like, no, you need the character.
Yeah.
You need the steps, but you need the character to carry you through those steps first. And I just love these takeaways that you're like, I didn't want the poor award. I didn't want that mindset.
Because I heard God say at 3:17 in the morning that when you're fasting, I took it from that Bible verse. When you're fasting, don't go around telling people and walking around with a long face. And I thought, that probably applies to everything else
right.
that you're going
right.
through. Like, don't walk around saying, oh,
poor me, I'm so pitiful.
Like,
and
nope, everybody has their own challenges. You don't
right.
know what those are. But if you can be grateful for where you are, like, you can't get more until you're
that's right.
grateful
that is
for what
biblical.
It is that
that's
you
right.
have.
That's right.
And so I think that was the thing that changed my life, because I think I was bitter.
Yeah.
I was a bitter woman. But I learned this wonderful lesson. As I've been able to go around and speak to people, doors have been open for me. And Dr. Jackson taught me this wonderful concept that none of us know our first name.
What do you mean by that?
And so it's like this, you know, hi, I'm Mignon.
Uh-huh, Christy, nice to
hi,
meet you.
Hi,
yeah.
Christy. But if you were to say it in a sentence, how would you say it to me? If you're going to introduce yourself to me, and I said, hi, I'm Mignon.
Hey, I'm Christy Wright.
Oh, right. Yeah. I'm Christy Wright. Nice to meet you. There's something similar about my name and your name. We both did the same thing. When I stuck my hand out to introduce you, you said the same thing that I said. And so I learned that on the day that I was born, my parents gave me a gift. That was my name. And that's because they wanted me to individually be recognized as I went throughout the world. And sometimes we're arrogant to believe that we place those names on our children when, in fact, those are funneled to us from the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
In the Bible, we see all these examples where God told people to name their children things, and they knew that those names came from the Lord. But now we're so far removed from God that we don't realize that God is still telling us what to name our children.
Yeah.
Otherwise, all Kimberlys wouldn't act the same.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
And so my parents gave me a name because they wanted me to know who I was and to stand out as an individual. And then they gave me something else. They gave me their name so that I would know whose I was.
Right.
So when I went into the street, if there was another Mignon, they would be distinguished that this is my Mignon. This is the family that I come from, so that I would know whose I was.
Mm-hmm.
But God also gave me something on the day that I was born. He gave me his name so that I would know that he would never leave me, that he would always be with me, and that is I am.
Mm. I love that.
The word of God says, who do men say that I am?
Mm-hmm.
We're all these, he's all these people.
Yeah.
He's living on the inside of all of us.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a Bible verse that says, tell them that I am sent you.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I say I am, I put on the first part of my name.
Oh, I love
that. So
that
I know that all things are possible for me.
That's right.
And when I think about the word impossible, it's just a contraction that says I am possible.
That's right.
That means that there's nothing that's impossible with God.
I love that.
And so God is always with you. He will never leave you or forsake you. And he's given you that promise to carry with you everywhere you go, even when you just speak your name.
Yeah, that's I've never heard it put that way. That's beautiful.
Yeah.
I love it. I love, because I think so often, Christine Kane talks about this, but so often we understand intellectually God is the creator of the universe and anything is possible with him, and we completely disconnect ourselves from that as that lives in us.
Mm-hmm.
That lives in us all day, every day, mm-hmm. that power, that spirit. And so I just love, I am. I
yeah.
love it. I'll never introduce myself the same way again. You know, I love it. Okay, before we wrap up, I want to talk specifically about belief, because we're talking about that in this show.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of those things, even as you tell your story, like you believed.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you didn't believe in yourself every single second. Maybe you didn't believe in your circumstances, but you always believed in a hope for the future, this
mm-hmm.
idea of choosing life. And I think that when you're in a hopeless situation, when your house is condemned, you're falling through the floors, you don't know how to bake out of a box, and the box that you did bake was not good, you got $5 to your name, like, how do you believe and how do you maintain belief? What keeps you anchored when you're going through those seasons where you don't have any proof around you that the future is good, that God does have a plan for you, that you don't have any signs or indications of how it's going to work out,
mm-hmm.
you know, where you're
mm-hmm.
standing in front of the Red Sea
uh-huh.
and God has brought you to this impossible
mm-hmm.
place.
Yes.
How do you have that faith that carries you through? Let's
I've
talk about that.
I've seen him do it.
Mm.
You know, I always love to teach about this. There is a Bible verse, Hebrews 11:1, says that now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. And what I love about that is one day I was sitting reading the Bible. Like, you have to know the promises in order to apply them. Like, you know, when you get in your car you believe that it's going to start.
Right.
You know, I believe that when I go and turn on the light switch, the lights are going to come on. These are things I believe because I've seen them happen. I've seen God perform in my life. I've also seen him perform in other people's lives. And I was like, God, what makes them better than me that you should give them more than you've given me? But I've got 7 children. I know I can't treat them all the same.
Right.
So the Bible says, according to your faith, be it unto you.
Wow.
So the same thing goes for people. You know, mothers could understand this. I can't treat Johnny the way that I treat Ashley because Ashley wants to stay after school. She wants to be on the cheerleading squad. She wants to join, you know, the 4-H club. She wants to do all this stuff. So I've got to change my schedule around, do all this stuff for Ashley because this is what Ashley has worked on.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Johnny just says, Mom, can you make sure that I have snacks because I'm going home?
Right.
Right?
Right.
And all I have to do is make sure that there's a roof over Johnny's head and Johnny is set and he's over here.
Thank God we all have some Johnnies in the family, right? Like, it's like, mamas are tired. We need a Johnny here and there. That's my Carter. Yeah.
But it's according to Ashley's faith.
That's right.
That as her mom, I have to show up for her.
That's right.
And do the things that she needs me to do as her mother.
That's good.
And I think that that's the way that God is. God says, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and does what? Opens it.
That's right.
Like, the door is not going to be open for you. You must open the door.
Right.
So work is required of us. And I think that that's what I realized, that it wasn't that they were more special than I was. It wasn't that they got a lucky break. It was like, what is the work that they put in? I started asking people, what did you do to get here?
Mm-hmm.
I began interviewing people like, why is it that you're here? Yeah. What did you do? And I started realizing some of the most successful and wealthy people came from some of the lowest.
I was going to say, I would be willing to bet that when you interviewed these successful, wealthy people, none of them said, I don't know, it was an accident.
Yeah.
I just woke up here one day on the mountain. No one said that, right? No one said it happened overnight.
Yeah.
It was easy. It was fast. And it was accidental.
Yeah.
No one said that. And we have this myth because what's amazing is when we completely remove successful people from the work required that got mm-hmm. them there, then it gives us an out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if it's out of your control, then it's out of my control mm-hmm. for me. I can just sit here and feel sorry for myself. But when you start to see, we live in a world where you reap what you sow.
Mm-hmm.
And there is the parable of the talents. When mm-hmm. you are faithful with a few things, you will be entrusted with many things. And mm-hmm. so I love that because even as you did research, you start to see there's a pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And God is a God of patterns.
Yeah.
Like you start to see
yeah.
this pattern.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay, work is required.
Yeah.
Dave Ramsey tells a great story that I love. I'm probably going to mess it up, but it's kind of a parable story about how a wealthy man was walking along a road and he passed this beautiful farm. Like mm-hmm. imagine a plantation with perfectly manicured fields and the landscaping and the house was painted, the fence, so everything was immaculate.
Mm-hmm.
And the farmer was out working the field and the businessman came along and he said, oh, wow, farmer, God has blessed you.
Mm-hmm.
God has blessed you with this beautiful, immaculate farm. And the farmer said, yes, he has. And you should have seen what it looked like when he had it to himself. In that, it's like, it's us and God.
Yes.
It's like, God will bless you and
right.
work the field.
Mm-hmm. Hebrews 11:1 says, now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. So if you want things, if you want to activate the heart of God, you got to get on his level.
Yeah.
Because God emptied out heaven for you that you might have life more abundantly or to the full.
Right.
And so if God emptied out heaven for you and you expect to do mediocre things, but then you want God to give you
right,
great and amazing
right.
blessings. It doesn't work that way.
Yep.
But when you activate now faith, you become on the same level of what he invested. Now faith is not having any evidence that what I believe is going to work. Now faith doesn't test it. Now faith doesn't know that when I get in my car, I'm going to turn this thing and it's going to start up and it's going to go. I've seen it happen.
Right.
Faith will allow you to believe in something that you've seen happen before,
yeah.
but now faith doesn't give you any warning.
Mm-hmm.
Now faith just says, hey, I believe that this will work, so I'm going to start doing it right now.
Yeah.
When you activate your now, you activate all you own, which puts you in line with what God said, I invested in you.
Yeah.
I invested everything in you. So now you're investing everything in God because you're giving him back all that you have, and all that you have is right now. You don't wait to say, well, God, I'm going to wait until you give me the money.
Right.
I'm going to wait until I graduate from college. I'm going to wait until my children grow.
I'm going to wait until I'm ready.
Yeah. There's a study that says that 98% or 95% of Americans are waiting for some big major event to happen before they start living. But this says, I will live right now. And when you O-W-N, you're N-O-W, what happens? You W-O-N.
Mm.
And that's what I realized. Mm-hmm. It was about perspective. That when I activate everything I got, God says, okay, now you're serious.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was serious about you, so I gave you everything I had. So give me everything, and then you can start asking me for more. I think that God wants to do more stuff. He wants to give us more stuff.
Right.
But you know what we keep asking him for? Simple things that he's like, I'm not doing that for
you.
I gave you the ability to tie your shoes, just like the farmer.
Right.
You know, you can you imagine what it looked like when he had it by himself?
Right.
Like, he gave you the opportunity, he gave you your hands, he gave you a mind, he gave you vision to be able to work something. That's why where there's no vision, people perish.
Because
you can't see
yep.
where you're going. You don't
there's
know.
There's no hope. There's no
what
yep.
to do with it.
Yep.
But God gave you the ability to tie your shoes, so you don't get to ask him, God, can you tie these shoes for me?
Yeah.
He's like, no, I'm not doing that.
That's right.
ask me for something
that's
more.
Right. Try again. I love this theme of how we've even come full circle to faith, because even I did a Devo for our company where we do devotional once a week. And in January, a couple years ago, I did this. And I was teaching from Matthew, and I'd never seen this correlation. I'd always seen a cause and effect in Scripture of because of your faith,
mm-hmm.
you've been healed. Because mm-hmm. of your faith, I will bless you. Because of your faith, because of your faith.
Mm-hmm.
Hebrews, the whole chapter of 11
yeah.
is by faith, Sarah, by faith, Abram, by faith, you know.
Yeah.
And so you start to see this correlation between faith and then God rewards that, God blesses that mm-hmm. and honors that. But in Matthew, there's a story where the disciples couldn't drive out a demon-possessed man, and they came to Jesus. Jesus drives out the demon, and they asked Jesus afterwards, like, hey, why couldn't we do that? And he
mm-hmm.
said, because you had so little faith.
Yeah.
So there's also the opposite cause mm-hmm. and effect of when we have a lack of faith, like you're saying, when we're mm-hmm. sitting here going, oh, poor me, or God, I don't know if you can do that.
Mm-hmm.
I'll wait till this circumstance gets changed, and then I'll live my life. God's not going to bless that.
Yeah.
He's not actually going to bless that. Mm-hmm. So I love it. Oh, Mignon, I could talk to you all day. I told y'all. She is a firecracker. I just love your story. I love your heart. I love how Jesus just shines through you, through the words that you share, that through the insights that you have. And you are leading this amazing business that people love the cake. So you have refined the recipe. She's these amazing, really cool recipes. We were talking about, what was it? Jack and Coke.
Yeah.
Jack and Coke cupcakes. Who doesn't want one of those? But I remind women all the time, they think there's this separation between business and the marketplace,
mm-hmm.
a for-profit, you know, secular marketplace
mm-hmm.
business and their faith. I'm like, no, God is in your business because
mm-hmm.
God is in you and you are in your business, and you are such an example of that. Tell
mm-hmm.
people, for anyone in Nashville, New Orleans, where they can find the cupcakes.
So we are at thecupcakecollection.com. We're on Twitter as Cupcake Tweets. We're on Facebook and Instagram as The Cupcake Collection. So those are all the places that they can find me. Or if they just want to talk to Mignon,
there you go.
I'm Mignon.Francois on Instagram.
Awesome. Thank you so, so much. Thanks so much for watching. And don't forget to subscribe to my YouTube channel. And now you can check out this next video.
Judge. One in a Million, the history of Madam C.J. Walker and her entrepreneurial legacy. Not even her poor and difficult beginnings stymied Madam Walker's road to greatness. Born December 23, 1867, roughly 2 years after the alleged emancipation of her race, she was an orphan at 7, a wife at 14, a mother at 17, and a widow by 20. The woman who would become known as the first self-made female millionaire and the greatest benefactress of her race was born the daughter of Owen and Minerva Breedlove, poor ex-slaves living on a cotton farm in Louisiana. They named their special little girl Sarah Breedlove. A washerwoman by trade, at the age of 33 in 1900, Sarah began selling a product door to door which she had formulated to remedy her own hair loss. She pinpointed the root of her hair problems, which was the scalp, and created hair care products and a beauty regimen for hair growth and maintenance that focused on the need for a clean and healthy scalp, scalp protection, and scalp stimulation for maximum hair growth. Her first product would eventually be called Madam C.J. Walker's Wonderful Hair Grower, and she boldly and proudly used her own likeness on her jars and her own before and after pictures to demonstrate her product's effectiveness. Per Madam's own words, she abhorred the impression held by some that she claimed to straighten hair. She emphatically stated, "I grow hair," and that there would be no hair-growing business today had I not started it. She described her concept and method of hair growth as beauty culture because she compared growing hair to growing and cultivating garden plants. She then broadened this concept of beauty culture by incorporating the value of cleanliness and professionalism, which emphasized the overall appearance, moral conduct, and character of the black woman. Black women from all over the country began writing letters to Madam Walker attesting to the benefits of her products. By setting up a special correspondence course of beauty culture in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and then a manufacturing facility in Indiana, and later a beauty college in New York City, Madam was able to further establish and promulgate her program of beauty culture, which trained the black female in three areas. First, the black woman was taught the proper presentation of herself. She was to be clean, neat, properly attired, and well-mannered. Second, she was taught how to use Madam's hair care system on customers. And third, she was taught how to sell Madam's hair care products to customers. In so doing, Madam C.J. Walker provided a solution to the root of the black woman's demise. She raised the black woman's self-esteem and confidence about her own beauty and intelligence, and she empowered the black woman economically, thus freeing her from white servitude and male dependency. This accomplishment is even more amazing when put in the context of the time in which these things were done and in the context of Madam's own background. The time, one historian called the nadir, or lowest point in the history of the black race outside of slavery itself. The blessings of freedom was now marred by the blatant terrorist acts of the Ku Klux Klan and those like-minded individuals working in collusion with them. The harsh reality faced by the vast majority of blacks living in this era was that the number of lynchings peaked during the early 1900s, as did other backlashes sparked by Reconstruction, such as the burning of black churches and schools and the establishment of Jim Crow laws. During this dark period, most black women were either sharecroppers or washerwomen and house servants for whites. Madam Walker was no exception, but she was, however, exceptional. Madam Walker moved her ever-expanding special correspondence course business, founded on her system of beauty culture, to Indianapolis, Indiana, on February 19, 1910. She then purchased and paid for her home, adjoining which was a factory and laboratory, located at 640 North West Street. She endeared herself to the citizens of Indianapolis when she contributed $1,000 to the establishment of the Senate Avenue YMCA. It is reported that she was the only woman to make such a donation. Madam herself, when referring to the YMCA donation, had this to say, quote, "In referring to that $1,000 gift, I don't want you to lay so much stress on it, and do not say that I am the only one. You might say that I was the first and caused others to awaken to the sense of their duty in helping deserving causes for the benefit of the race," end quote. Not long after her move to Indianapolis, Madam Walker also became a member of Bethel AME Church, one of the oldest and most influential churches in the black community, to which Madam Walker contributed generously. In less than 2 years after moving to Indianapolis, on September 2, 1911, Madam C.J. Walker petitioned the Indiana Secretary of State to become incorporated, and on September 19, 1911, exactly 1 year and 7 months since her arrival in Indianapolis, the Madam C.J. Walker Manufacturing Company of Indiana Incorporated was established, Madam Walker naming herself president and owner of all 1,000 shares of stock. A relentless worker and ingenious marketer and saleswoman, Madam Walker had thought to place her system of hair care products in black colleges all across the United States. She also regularly advertised in black newspapers, and she eventually placed her products in drugstores. As she traveled throughout the country, she wrote letters to her general manager in order to instruct him on how best to run her factory in her absence and how to implement all of her new ideas. However, the Madam Walker agents, Madam's recruited sales force, were her biggest asset. Madam held public meetings in churches, rented lodge halls and other such facilities, and put on demonstrations, including a slide presentation, in order to recruit black women to become Walker agents. Madam Walker taught and trained them in the methods of application and proper use of her hair oils and vegetable shampoo. Eventually, Madam organized a national convention for her Walker agents, giving away prizes and other incentives to motivate and energize her ever-growing troops of Walker agents. Sales generated from Madam Walker's manufacturing company and the hair care products it produced enabled Madam to give birth to yet another legacy, as Madam became known as the greatest benefactress of her race. Through monies earned and derived from Madam's work in the hair-growing business, Madam Walker regularly donated large sums of money to charity and to individuals of her race who were in need. In fact, Madam was so self-sacrificing and freely giving that those closest to her were worried that she would become financially ruined. Desiring all blacks to have decent homes, at times, Madam would assume mortgages of blacks who were financially strapped, allowing them to repay when and how they could. Various schools for blacks and certain social and civic organizations dedicated to the betterment of the black race were also beneficiaries of Madam's philanthropy. Though many have called Madam extravagant, her generosity and passion for her people were Madam's only extravagances. She gave not for self-aggrandizement, but rather to inspire other wealthy blacks to give likewise. Moreover, Madam's giving went well beyond monetary donations. She lent her name and time to worthy causes. She traversed the country, speaking against lynchings, and fought vehemently for the fair treatment of black soldiers who had served in America's military during World War I. Madam C.J. Walker was an ambassador of sorts, a spokesperson for all black-skinned people, a revolutionary, visionary, missionary force. It should therefore be quite obvious that Madam Walker's passing on May 25, 1919 was a tremendous loss to the black race. At that time, Madam had recruited over 25,000 black women from the United States, Central America and the Caribbean as door-to-door beauty culturist and was well on her way to Africa. Her net worth was over $1 million, making her the first female, regardless of color, to become a self-made millionaire. She is one of the most successful black entrepreneurs of all time and one of the first to utilize the method known today as direct sales marketing to distribute her products. She had also managed to build a 32-room mansion in Irvington, New York called Villa Loaro, which she had desired to be left as a monument to her name and as an example to her race of what hard work and black support of black enterprises could achieve. After Madam's 1919 passing, her hair care manufacturing corporation was used as collateral to secure the finances needed to build what is today known as the Madam Walker Theater Building. Completed in late 1927, the Walker Building Beauty Salon continues to operate there and continues to sell Madam C.J. Walker's original hair care products. Years later, in 1982, the trustees of Madam Walker's trust would deposit a large portion of Madam C.J. Walker Manufacturing Company's business records, historical documents, pictures, and memorabilia with the Indiana Historical Society, who took on the task of painstakingly organizing and preserving the Madam Walker legacy. 74 years after the incorporation of the Madam Walker Company in 1985, the 1,000 shares of capital stock of Madam's corporation were sold to a man named Raymond L. Randolph, making him the first person since Madam Walker herself to own all 1,000 shares of stock in the original Madam Walker Company. A graduate of Attucks High School, Mr. Randolph had never dreamed that he would become the owner and caretaker of this phenomenal legacy. In honor of Madam C.J. Walker, Mr. Randolph placed Madam Walker's image back on the jars of her original hair care products with the words, "Since 1911," placed underneath it. Doing business today as Madam C.J. Walker Enterprises Incorporated, the hair care company founded by Madam C.J. Walker continues to manufacture and sell her original quality products, ensuring that the legacy of this remarkable woman never dies. The Madam Walker Agent Program has been reinstituted and is the main method by which her products are distributed today. On September 24, 2011, Madam C.J. Walker Enterprises sponsored a centennial celebratory walk called Tracing the Footsteps of a Legacy. This event marked the 100th year since the pivotal point in her entrepreneurial legacy when Madam Walker incorporated her manufacturing company, the Madam C.J. Walker business family, which includes the Madam Walker agents, will continue to keep Madam Walker's spirit alive and well by ensuring that her labor of love, her manufacturing business, continues operating according to the entrepreneurial blueprint she left behind and which is detailed in the historical documents of the company. Thank you. Thank you, Sarah Breedlove. You are indeed one in a million.
All right. This is we're still in our birthday week. We turned 8 years old on December the 24th, about 5 days ago. It's my house. And we weren't on here for 3 weeks, but we were online. We were on Clubhouse. So let me – I'll put out some announcements with Anchor. But we're on Clubhouse every day. Monday – well, not every day, but Monday through Friday. So it's like today we're on – now we've got a It's My House TV Clubhouse – well, they call them rooms on Clubhouse. So we have that. But – the regular, the, let me put it this way. The additional platform of this platform, It's My House, on Clubhouse. The club that we have on Clubhouse is titled Housing on Demand. Housing on Demand. All right. And to get Clubhouse, because there's no call-in numbers for Clubhouse, you have to download the app onto your favorite listening device. For me, I have it on my smartphone. Okay. But you can probably download it to your tablet or desktop or laptop or whatever your favorite listening device is. So we're on Clubhouse. And under our Clubhouse name of Housing on Demand, all right, and that's at 6:30 Eastern Standard Time, 5:30 Central Standard Time, just for your local time zone, wherever you are. You're on the West Coast, Pacific time zone. That'll be like 3:30. If you're in Alaska or Hawaii, you know, adjust for your local time zone based on the Eastern time zone of 6:30. So we'll be on there live. We've been doing test drives on there for the last 3 weeks. All right. No extended program like we do here on Blog Talk. All right. Now, on that particular, like I say, on Clubhouse, they call those rooms. On there, all we talk that's just designed for promoting offline events. Like with us, our assignment for 2022 is every weekend we build, Saturday and Sunday we build, and the first activity before we even get to the build part is we have community meals. Now, we're planning those now. So, like the guest we had on this morning, she's out of Nashville. So we'll have offline community meals in Nashville, Tennessee, as well as Hamilton County, Florida. That's where I'll be at. But we'll announce those areas based on, because we had to have a on the ground, boots on the ground partner in those locations. So you heard one of our boots on the ground partners as we opened the podcast this morning, Miss Lola Denise Brown. She's a boots on the ground partner, and so we'll start off with just a plain and simple community meal of consisting of no more than 10 people. That includes the host, the hostess, no more than. And then after that, now wherever I'm at, we'll have a community meal up to 4 on a weekend, midday and then dinner, all right, with a building project. But to start off, to start off, it's just a community meal, and we're saying you budget, you know, there's a $20 budget. So Robin went through, what, yesterday or the day before? Or yesterday? You know, how to feed 10 people on $20. So we'll have a Zoom call on that, and then we're into action next month in January. And then it'll be a community meal with a community project. And those projects might vary from physical boots on the ground location, but one staple of we'll have a building project for housing. That'll be a staple along with the community meal. Okay. All right. Let's see. All right. So stay tuned for that. Once again, we'll be on Clubhouse. Yeah. Some people might not be Clubhouse people. For those who don't know, Clubhouse is an audio app, which I don't know, it could get up as large as Facebook. I wouldn't be surprised. It's still small right now, but I mean it's meet some very interesting people on there. Very interesting people on there. And in addition, now we've got It's Miles TV Club on there, and that's typically a simulcast of this when we do this. And then, you know, our regular Blog Talk thing. Then we have the 6:30 edition, which is Housing on Demand. We don't discuss anything. Anything we discuss on here really is not discussed on here. No trending topics, no reparations talks, nothing like that. And then we have a radio station, or a de facto radio station that we're putting on there. The room's already, because I like to say on Clubhouse, they call them rooms. It's on there already. Hopkins Park Radio. Hopkins Park Radio. And we're going to have other radio stations that we're going to put on there. Now, let me tell you how that works, starting with Hopkins Park Radio. Hopkins Park Radio is based on the boots-on-the-ground activities that happen in Hopkins Park, Illinois, and Pembroke, Illinois. So all of the content, at least 75 to 80% of the people that you hear on there on a daily basis will be people that actually live, work, or play, or all of the above, in Hopkins Park, Illinois, in Pembroke, Illinois. Hopkins Park is a village within the township of Pembroke, Illinois. But they don't have a local radio station. Therefore, we set up Hopkins Park Radio. Because let's face it, I'm here on Blog Talk, and we've got listeners that listen in Russia, Mongolia, different parts of Africa, Asia, I don't know, maybe even Antarctica, I don't know. There's a lot of places. But the only thing is, if we have an offline event for a community meal, somebody in Mongolia is not going to come to Hopkins Park or Hamilton County, Florida for that. That's why we've been test driving on Hopkins Park, because and a lot of local radio stations, for some reason, they don't focus in on the local community like they used to. So we said, you know what, if there's no radio station in this particular part or neck of the woods where we're at, okay, where we got some listeners, then what we're going to do is invent a platform. Thus, our first radio station or de facto radio station, Hopkins Park Radio. So anybody interested in what's happening in Hopkins Park, Illinois, or Pembroke, Illinois, and those places are about an hour away from Chicago. But we'll be just like we had Miss Brown on this morning. She's in Nashville. We'll have a station on Clubhouse dedicated to our niche market in Nashville, Tennessee. All 75 to 80% of the programming, about 80 to 95%, more or less 90 to 95% of the programming that we'll have for the Nashville Boots on the Ground station that we'll bring through Clubhouse. You know, it'll be local people that live in the Nashville local area, projects that we have, that we'll have in that area, things that are happening in that area. Okay, so that's the way we, so as we open up the stations via the Steve Harvey 10x10 method, we'll let you know. All right, so. But we'll keep It's My House here, where, we'll cover trending topics and things of that nature. All right, we got time to take one call. We're in overtime today as we usually go. 314, your mic is open.
What's going on, L.A.?
Oh, man, everything. A lot's going on. We're reorganizing. Things are looking up. So I'm a happy camper right now. I'll put it that way.
You ain't over there on that place talking about no the white man's the devil and stuff, is you?
No, but on Clubhouse, you do have people that set up rooms that way, but I don't participate in that.
Well, me neither. I ain't coming over there listening to all that garbage.
No, but they got all kind of rooms over there. I mean, if you want to learn, you know what? It's really like Blog Talk, except you can go on 5 hours, 10 hours, 12 hours on a topic. Want to learn a language, so yeah. And there's no phone number to dial into. So I'm looking at it right while this app is absolutely free right now. Because, for instance, where you're at in St. Louis, okay, I don't know what kind of radio stations that they have there, but typically radio can be expensive. It can pay for itself, but it can be expensive. But a lot of people that used to listen to terrestrial radio, they're online now. So we figure out, let's set up, if we want to penetrate a local market.
See if it works then. That's all you can do.
We'll get a boots on the ground person in that particular market, and then we'll program everything. Well, 80 to 90% of the programming, we're focusing on what's happening in St. Louis or whatever particular market that we're interested in having a boots on the ground relationship with. That's where we're at right now. Anyway, well, what's going on? We've been going on with you for the last 3 weeks. Oh, you know what? He dropped off. All right. On that note, I guess that's our cue. We're going to leave it off for today. See you guys here tomorrow.